This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
So welcome. We're now in the Gallery of First Australians, which looks at the histories and cultures of Australia's Indigenous people, both Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And we're standing in front of the second of the collections that inspired Elena when she first came to the museum, which is a display of what are called Kimberley Points. These are objects made by the Aboriginal peoples of the Kimberley region of northwest Australia. As you can see, they look a lot like spearheads, which is in essence what they are, but they're very particular, special kinds of spearheads. Obviously, Aboriginal people in the Kimberley have been making stone spearheads for thousands of years. But when Europeans first started moving into that region in the early 19th century, they began to adapt their traditional practice in a very interesting and very inventive way. They started to make spearheads not only from stone, but also from some of the other materials you see here, and particularly from glass, which came from mostly from bottles, but also from porcelain or ceramic, which was acquired from the insulation caps on telegraph lines. You'll be able to see there's a few you can see that are a sort of pearly white ceramic, and they're ones made from the actual insulation caps, which is, I think, a marvellous sort of adaptation. These spearheads were predominantly created not necessarily for use, not to be used for hunting or other uses of spears, but rather as important ceremonial exchange objects. Obviously, when Europeans arrived in the Kimberley, there were already very extensive trade networks established between Aboriginal peoples. But once new trade goods started coming into the region, things like metal, which was very useful, things like tobacco, which was highly sought after, these ceremonial exchange networks started to grow and to become much more active and much more intense because it was a great idea. You know, Aboriginal people were very keen to get their hands on metal, which was a fantastic material. And they started to, these objects started to develop and get larger and more complex, and I think, you know, arguably more beautiful, because they were very important objects in those trade cycles. So if you could trade a rather lovely, large spearhead, you would get, obviously, be able to trade that for a greater amount of metal or tobacco or flour or these other kinds of goods. And they also, I think, changed the style of the spearhead somewhat. Traditionally, stone spearheads were flaked only on one side, because if you try to flake it on both sides, they tended to break very easily. But it turned out that glass and porcelain were a different structure. They're a different kind of material. They're easier to flake in some ways, and that's why you get these what are called bifacial spearheads, which means they're flaked on both sides. And they would have been flaked by specialist craftsmen who used, first of all, a stone, a hammer stone, to actually create a rough shape, and then used a wooden implement, and finally a bone, usually the forearm of a kangaroo, to actually do the fine shaping around the edges. This collection, most of the points in this collection were acquired actually by anthropologists and collectors, European collectors in the first part of the 20th century, and they were mostly brought together and then given to an institution called the Institute of Anatomy, which used to occupy what is now the National Film and Sound Archive. The Institute of Anatomy had a very large collection relating to Australia's Aboriginal people, and it closed in the early 80s, and its whole collection then came to the National Museum. And when this facility was opened in 2001, the decision was made to display this collection of Kimberley points very much in this style that emphasises their aesthetic nature as much as their functional nature as spearheads. So I think Elena had a very strong reaction to this display, particularly rather than just to the collection. So Elena, I'll hand over to you to talk a little bit about it and then play a wonderful piece. Thank you.
Well, this is my favourite object. This is the one I saw when I saw it after lots of others. I just thought this is the one. I could write the whole symphony actually about just that. The poetry of it, the lyricism of it, the transparency of it, and for me it looks like a forest, very transparent forest. Everybody sees something else, I guess. It's my impression, but something very airy, and I thought it needed a lot of space, and I didn't use any brass instruments in this piece. It was basically piano, pizzicato strings, and a few woodwinds with the melody, and I wanted it to be very light, not at all heavy, and if heavy, then only in special moments, and where kind of it's still quite vast. This feeling of vastness was important to me. So occasionally, there's not much happening in the music. Right hand will do kind of a background thing, a pattern, and whereas left hand does what pizzicato strings were doing, and it will just basically do something that's not even a melody. It's just something that's kind of inactive. I didn't want too active, but of course I can't stop myself, and I had to write a piece. It has to be something. So there is a melody eventually, but it grows out of very non-melodic kind of material. So, and I love this dearly. This is just the best, the most beautiful object ever, I think. Plus the history of it is so inspiring.
Thank you, Elaine. It was wonderful. We have, again, a little bit of time for questions. If anybody has any questions or just reflections. Yes, just over this side. Just one. Whoops.
Two questions, if I may. One for the curator as well.
Yes.
When Aboriginal people practising traditional culture found these objects in remote areas, did they then use them for their own culture, i.e. Cutting their skin to create Aboriginal scarring patterns for tribal castes?
It was actually Aboriginal people in the remote areas who made these objects. They were, the trading network I'm talking about really stretched all the way through the Kimberley, all the way down into central Australia and up into northern Australia. So these objects were made in several different areas of the Kimberley and were then traded through all these different areas. But as I said, principally they were used more for as exchange items, as essentially desirable items of aesthetic appeal, rather than utilitarian items.
So you don't know whether they've actually used them as cutting objects, whether on their own body or on other things?
Certainly they were not used predominantly as cutting objects for, you know, cutting meat or cutting animals. I don't know about using them for scarring purposes. I don't know that.
And a question for Lennon, if I may. The other four movements in the Garden of Dreams, which sections, or what's the name for those pieces and which section of the museum inspired those?
Okay, they're broad, very broad. These two movements are the most obvious because I actually was basing the pieces on the objects. The other four are different. The first one was called Beethoven, Sun and Sea. It was to do with the history of the actual music as well and culture that comes sometimes from Europe or from anywhere else, from inside Australia. And it was a mixture of, that's where I actually used this didgeridoo. And I used a piece of Beethoven's Symphony No. 7, the famous slow movement. And I kind of incorporated it into the piece. The second movement was the Love Token. The third was called Industrial Blues, and it was actually inspired by the building itself. And I saw strange things in this building. You know, things are a bit lopsided. You know, where on the stairs you see a kind of square concrete box which is almost falling off, but it's actually built in, and it's kind of inspired. I thought it was very unusual and witty. Engineering, a kind of piece of engineering, and I thought it was kind of a great way of putting a little bit of humor into this huge, big, monumental piece of architecture. Plus, of course, it was meant to be a museum, so I just thought it was really unusual. So I wrote this kind of almost comical piece, but not quite. It's called Industrial Blues, based a lot on brass instruments. And then the fourth movement was the Kimberley Points. And the fifth, I always wanted to write a piece, and I consider myself part of a history. So I thought I might as well do something I wanted to always write, and that was the piece of Schubert called Fantasy in F minor for four hands. And I've always wanted to write it write a tribute to this piece since I was a child. And I kind of thought this is the right moment to do it because there is... A lot of the objects here have no chronology. Like you don't quite know there is the logic of it. Logic of it is not quite obvious. And so I thought if I can throw in this one piece that I hold dear, and I would really like to use that piece in this whole big suite, I thought maybe I'll be forgiven. And I did, and it's a piece, it just goes basically in my piece, it goes like that. It's quite heavy. Whereas originally it's quite a delightful poetic piece, so it's more like it's actually different. I completely put it on its head, as I think this museum is a little bit. Also, the Garden of Australian Dreams, as it was I was inspired by that to call my piece Garden of Dreams. So, which is also a little bit quirky in lots of objects of it. Some of them are also upside down and reverse, and, you know, it's kind of interesting. And the last movement, so this one is called Schubert Engine, because it's like an engine. It's pretty almost like a machine. The last movement I called Evolving, and I brought back didgeridoo and singing as well. And so it kind of was showing that this is part of where we are now, but it's not finished. It's never going to be finished because it's going to be evolving, and the collection is going to be evolving. A lot of this, probably this event will be part of the history. You know, everything is constantly piling up, and it was basically like this. So it was kind of fast-moving something, and then it finished with William Barton singing. So and it went for quite a while. So he sang quite a long time at the end with the cellos and double basses holding the low note. So it's kind of just to bring it back to earth. So the piece starts with the didgeridoo and the kind of the earthiness of it, and finishes with didgeridoo. So it's kind of like a circle. I see it as a circle. That's why I like the six movements, like six number six. It's just like a circular. Three times two, and it's just a lot of things play a role in my music, and so that's shaped. It was about 25 minutes long.
I always think one of the great, you know, perfect things about your composition, Lena, is the way its response to the museum, and that it combines a response to objects, to personal history, to a kind of broader human history, but also not a narrow interpretation of a national history, the idea about Australia's interaction with many traditions from around the world as well. Yeah, it was good job in 2 days.
Thank you.
Yeah, so just wait for the microphone, please, and then thanks.
I don't need that.
Thank you.
Does William have a good voice?
He has a brilliant voice. It's very earthy. It's not operatic voice. It's human, and he has an incredible ear for other people's music, and he has ear for inside, internal ear, and it's pretty great, actually. Yeah, it's kind of a mixture between pop and not, and I don't know. It's he's just capable. He's just very, very talented person. He can also sing while he plays didgeridoo. That's another skill altogether. But I think it's part of it, actually. You have to be able to do that, I think, as well. And I mean, he's just great musician, wonderful to work with.
Amazing breathing, if you can sing and play the didgeridoo at the same time.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, you sort of breathe into the instrument, you get some kind of overtones then extra. Yeah.
Wow. Any other questions? I just wanted to ask again whether, I know we talked a little bit about it before, but the way when you revisit the music, when you play it again in a new environment, and I think this was one movement particularly that, you know, when we were talking about it, that it actually, in the way you're playing it here, is a slightly different style than the way it was kind of rendered in the first performance.
It was much faster in the original performance. And I felt, because I always saw this as a dance, so my piece, because of that, became kind of a dance piece. And I wanted something that moves and at the same time something static. So two things going at the same time, so a pattern and then static. This kind of living space. And while I was here, right, you know, just yesterday, the day before, I just felt fast is not good here. You know, it just doesn't feel right because there is much more space between the objects and you kind of want to give it a little bit. I think I probably still played it faster than I probably should have, but you kind of keep, you know, that's called also evolving. You know, you keep changing your mind about things. And I think it's important to reflect, to respond to the space, you know. Also, it's a bigger space. And at home, when you sit at home, you know, it doesn't feel so fast. Doesn't feel so fast. It feels like just something just moving. You know, you don't quite know the little parts of it. You don't notice. Just, you know. Whereas here, you kind of hear everything. You want to spread it out. So it's just different. Maybe in a year, I'll have another opinion. You know, and in different space.
Get you back next year again to do it. To do it again. Yes, another question here.
When you did your two-day tour before writing the piece, did you toy with the idea of doing something around the section of the museum based on Federation?
Also, yes. I did, and at the time I think there was a different installation there that's not anymore there. Yes, I did, but the date didn't fit right, and I just... I don't know. I go for smaller things rather than big things. Like big historic things don't interest me as opposed to in the music. To write a piece about something very big, I don't feel I'm big enough. you know, this is a funny thing. I know it's strange, but I feel I'm too a small a person to write something so big about something that's so important. I mean, this is important too, but I can relate to this better because it's smaller and I can kind of feel the people who did it. I can feel the connection, whereas Federation is way too big an event, you know. That's just, again, a symphony. That's a real symphony, maybe with the choir and, you know, much bigger than I think I could do at the time, you know. I probably just didn't feel ready, but, you know, you never know. Next time, another celebration.
Both the collections you chose are very much collections where we don't necessarily know the individual people who made, you know, we don't know which person made
but
each of these elements.
And, I can see that somebody has done this, you know, stippling, and I feel somebody has done this work with glass, and that is the connection I kind of immediately get drawn to, and I find inspiration in this. Whereas the historic event, I can only connect to it if I actually connect to people who were behind it or who were there, and a story about them. Otherwise, I find it too big. You know, where do you start? Where do you finish? Then you need a dramaturg to come on board and help you. You know, it's like a theatre piece then. You know.
When you're playing that music, I can hear more or less the chord combination. So do you have a vocal counter melodies or that will go along with some of these scores in movement?
Originally, no. There was orchestra and, for example, that bit was played by oboe and clarinet sometimes, depending. So the other instruments were, the chords were pizzicato strings and piano as well. And sometimes there was cello playing that as well. So it's not excluded. It can be sung. It can be sung, absolutely.
Yeah. Lends itself.
It's true. It's true, actually.
So you haven't written any words yet.
No, I haven't. I don't write words. I don't write words, but it is possible, and it's a good idea, actually. Yeah, I might do that. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I'm getting all these great ideas. Thank you.
Down the back.
I really don't know quite what to say, but I found the music quite evocative. And I'm not a musical person, really. I'm sort of tone deaf, I think. But I think the opportunity that the museum has made for us, and sitting in front of those the pieces of art, and listening to the music, was really quite, I guess, emotional. And I was thinking, wow, those things look very much like, you know, obelisks you might see in stones in the French countryside sometimes, and maybe in Britain, and the Egyptian obelisk. And I think, someone, as you were saying, has sat down and made these things. I almost felt as though I could sense that in the music, whether it was your deliberate or not, I don't know. But I really thank you very much. It was very, very important, I think.
Thank you. Well, I think the best thing is when you hear a piece and you look and they start moving. And I think that's the best. When you kind of suddenly think, because I've actually done that, and I looked, and after a while they start kind of shifting. It's kind of interesting. And then, of course, with the music, they may do that to the rhythm. So it's interesting. And also, somebody yesterday said they saw birds. Everybody sees something different, and somebody saw raindrops. No? And of course, it could be a pyramid. It could be. There's so many objects that look like that, and that's what's so beautiful about it. No? It can be interpreted in so many ways, and doesn't have to be interpreted at all at the same time. So it's great, and I think it's a privilege for me too to play it in front of this beautiful object. It's really the best. I mean, one of the best things I've seen in my life.
Whilst I thought of raindrops, but were any of these things used for plucking instrument sounds?
Because
that's
Aboriginals
not known to originally have stringed instruments and plucking sounds, but these seem to lend themselves to that type of thing.
Fragile, no? A little bit, no?
I think traditionally they wouldn't have been used for plucking instruments. As you say, stringed instruments weren't a large part of Aboriginal culture traditionally, but it would be interesting now to know. I don't know.
It lends itself to more string works, plucking sounds, whatever combinations that can be used with the violins, etc.
Thank you.
I think we're pretty much at the end of our time, unless anybody's got a burning question that they must ask. I wanted to say thank you very much to everybody here for coming, and particularly to the museum staff who made this possible. I think I'll say it's been a special thank you out to Gabrielle, who was so significant in initiating the whole project with Elena. But of course, very much thank you to Elena Katz-Turner for coming along yesterday and today to revisit these pieces and, as I said, participating in a little bit of an experiment for the museum. And I think comment from the gentleman at the back about how it is a very unusual and interesting experience to be able to sit and listen to this and look at the objects at the same time. I must say, for me yesterday, and when we were setting up on Wednesday, it was a very moving experience, one that I didn't expect in quite the same way. So it's certainly been a wonderful learning experience for me as well. So, Elena, thank you so much for coming along. It's been an absolute pleasure having you, and hopefully we'll see you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Join me in thanking Elena.
Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.